I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, welcome to the Curator Podcast. This is episode 10. Hi, hello, welcome once again, dear listener, to the Curator Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Fraser, and this is episode 10. I don't know about you, but I'm pretty chuffed that I've made it this far. Turning up to do something and remaining consistent is a difficult thing to do when it's just a hobby. But as I've found out over the past couple of weeks, there's a whole bunch of people listening to this wee podcast. I think I've said thanks like a million times. So I'm thanking you again, whether you like it or not. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. Before I started this podcast, I did a whole bunch of research. And by the way, if you want to do your own podcast, there's a whole lot of great resources out there, some of which you'll find in the show notes below. But there's always been one thing that stuck out to me. Most podcasts don't make it past episode 7. This is now episode 10, so I mean, that's a pretty big deal for me. When I get to number 50, I've got something cool planned. Not that I want to keep you in suspense or anything, but you'll just have to wait and see. On this episode, I spoke to Derek from Make That A Take Records. Make That A Take are an institution in Scotland, as far as I'm concerned. Their honesty, passion and commitment to punk rock is the absolute embodiment of the punk rock frame of mind. Deacon had a lot to say about his passion for punk, where the origins of Make That A Take lie, and above all, we spoke with real conviction on the things that continue to make his record label something worth doing. Make That A Take are, in the truest sense of the word, a collective, and they espouse anti-racist, anti-sexist, anti-fascist and anti-homophobic values, attitudes which are all very close to my heart and are, I would like to think, something that you can get behind as well. So I sat down with Deacon on a couple of benches outside a church on Bath Street in Glasgow. The sound was actually quite good given the circumstances, despite the fact you can hear the crowd in the background and There's some seagulls overhead that you can hear. But I think it gives it a nice texture. It gives it a proper rough and tumble DIY feel. The sound snob in me still longs to do all of this in a studio, but I can't see that ever being a case. I mean, even a garage like Mark Maron would be fine, but I can't ever really see myself owning a house. So, you know. But as I said, turning up and doing something with consistency is difficult when it's not a job, because life has a habit of getting in the way sometimes. Make That A Take Records is a true testament to the hard work and commitment of everybody involved. As of next year, they'll have been around for 10 years. And 10 years is a long time to be doing anything. And Make That A Take have a lot to show for it, having released a sheer mountain of records in that time. I thoroughly recommend checking out their website if you want to see what they've been up to. As ever, before we get into the chat, I'd like to play a track which has been picked by the interviewee. Derek sent me over the tracks to add, and after reading his descriptions of them, I'm actually a bit gutted that I didn't ask him to say them on tape. So instead, you just need to settle for me reading it. So with that in mind, we're opening with Treading by a band called Caddish from their LP Thick Letters to Friends. And this is what Derek had to say about it. Caddish are very possibly one of my favourite bands on earth. I've known them since I was 16 years old and I've watched them grow as a band and as human beings. They are the most wonderful, thoughtful, humble people, and they're a jaw-dropping band. To me, they are utterly peerless. We'll be right back.
The fact shop that will be broken will be smothered. A hard stop that all that matters lasts forever.
How you doing?
I'm good, thanks. How are you doing?
I'm not bad, man. You're here for, was it Stuck in Summertime?
Stuck in Summertime Fest, yes.
Tell us a wee bit how that came about before we get into the nitty-gritty.
Well, friends with Fraser from the Murder Burgers and Greg from the Kimberley Steaks. This weekend of shows kind of came about in a bit of a happenstance fashion, as tends to happen with punk rock. We were doing a show in Dundee originally for the Fur Coats, and an American band called Rubrix and Revenge of the Psychotronic Man, who have just played. And then Rubrix pulled out, and then a couple other tours were happening, and it all kind of crossed over together. So rather than people trying to compete in whatever, in the sense of our cooperative punk rock community, we're like, why don't we just combine this all and make it a weekender? So we did Edinburgh, we did Dundee last night, Friday night, Glasgow today, and tomorrow we've got a Lethal Lottery show in Edinburgh. So it all just came together quite organically, I guess.
So that's kind of indicative of the punk rock community, I guess you could say.
I think so, yeah. We're all into the same thing, you know. We're all essentially pulling in the same direction, so I think it makes sense for people to come together rather than try to compete, because our community is quite a small community, but it's quite hands-on and cohesive at the same time. So especially in Scotland, I like to think that everybody's kind of on the same level, and it makes it easy to work together.
So I guess that's kind of part of the whole DIY ethic that Make That Tick have. Where did that come from, do you think?
I think it probably came from the fact that at its very foundation, Michael and I started making music together when we were kids. We grew up in Aileth, who... You might have seen Aileth in the news recently with all the floods and collapsed bridges and such like due to the weather. That's where we grew up. So we started playing music together almost 20 years ago. And Michael's uncle was in a folk band. And once the kind of older guys realised that we weren't just taking the piss, that we were actually quite serious about music, they kind of took us under their wing a wee bit. And taught us how to be self-sufficient, how to put on your, like, how to put your own gear together was the first thing that we learned, how to put a PA together, how to do your own sound. So we learned that all from, like, the old folk guys and the guys that played in the covers bands in Aileth and around there. And we were too young at that time to put on gigs or play in pubs or clubs. And there was nowhere for us to play, even if we wanted to. So we put on our first gig when I was 13 at a birthday party at a girl guide hut in Aileth. So I guess in a way we were DIY before we knew that DIY was a thing, just because growing up in the country you had to create your own entertainment, and if you wanted to play a punk rock show you had to do it yourself. So that's really the root of where we learned to be DIY, and it was only later on growing into the punk scene that we found out that DIY was actually a thing. And I certainly instantly identified with that and was like, well, this is a thing, we can do this. And it all just kind of trickled on from there.
So I guess, is that the genesis of Make That A Take, or was it just your own musical genesis, or was it kind of intertwined?
I think it's probably intertwined. We did that show and... we've always done like our own flyers and our own posters and all that kind of shit. And then when I went to uni, like a few years later, we started playing, putting on gigs in a garage that was actually a shared storeroom with the University Drama Society. So we used to empty out all their stuff, have a show, have a piss up and whatever, tidy up afterwards, put all their stuff back in, and no one would ever know. And we only ever advertised it like to our friends and with flyers and stuff. So we did that for quite a long time until we got rumbled. And then we tried to kind of play ball with the university, like the union, and tried to play by the rules and stuff. And then, of course, as soon as they find out it's hardcore or punk rock, they're like, oh, turn it down. And you're like, no, well, you misunderstand what the concept and the entire point of this. And I guess it just kind of rolled on through there from our own experience. And I think we formalised Make That A Take. I remember it clear as day, actually. In my old man's house in Aileth, we had a house party gig. We just set up PA in the living room. And my dad was pretty cool. He was down with it, you know. And we all got drunk. And then we were sitting one night, that night afterwards, and we're like, we should do a thing. And we were playing in different bands at the time. And no one was really interested in putting us out or whatever. So we're like, yeah, we'll just do it ourselves. And we did the 15 Minutes album, and we did a Try Hards CD and one of my Tragical History Tour CDs. And that was basically the genesis of the label. And we started doing shows around about the same time. And through trial and error and ups and downs and years of figuring that shit out, we're almost at 10 years. So it'll be 10 years next year. Which is pretty crazy to think that it's been that long. But at the same time, kind of been doing it for about 20 years, because I'm going to be 33 this year, and I was 13 when we put on our first show. So I feel, anyway, in my heart of hearts, we've still got that same kind of childhood, boyish spirit about it. And personally, I still get as stoked now for doing something as I did back then. And if I ever lose that sort of excitement, I think that's when I'll know that it's time to knock it on the head, or maybe do something else, or just see how things evolve, because there was no plan to begin with, really. So everything else that's happened since then has been a kind of strange and unexpected bonus.
So is there a plan now, or is it still kind of by the seat of your pants style shit?
We've got, by necessity, the plan has had to get a bit longer in the vision. Like with Book Your Rain Fest, for example, that we need to start thinking about that like a year in advance. So we don't have like a 5-year or a 10-year plan, but we do have an idea of where we're wanting to go. It's a bit more structured than it was previously. But we've got our releases mapped out for at least the next 6 months for the end of this year. And we've got most of our shows booked for this year. And Book Your Rain Fest almost done. So everything for this year is on point. And we'll just see what next year brings. Next year being the 10th anniversary and the 10th Book Your Rain Fest. Even though Book Your Rain Fest didn't start in the same year as the label, because we did two Book Your Rain Fests in the first year. So there was one in the November and one in the June, I think. So it's actually 8 years, but 10 fests. It's just serendipity that it turns out to be Fest 10 and Year 10. So we've got some plans for next year. So it's taken, to answer the question, it's taken a bit more structure, and we have a vision of what we want to do, but we're also very open to things that pop up as well. Like, you don't want to be too tunnel visioned about it, but at the same time, you don't want it to be a meaningless chaos. You need to have some order to what you want to do if you want to do the job well. Because for me personally, there's nothing more frustrating than doing a half-assed job or something not going as well as it could. And I guess that's embedded into how we do things as well, because we've been doing it a long time. We like to treat people how we'd like to be treated ourselves. We like to treat bands well. I think it's standard across the board, but every time a touring band or visiting bands come, we like to feed them, put them up, pay them what we tell them that we're going to pay them, make sure they have a good time, and make sure the people that come to the shows as well have a good time and feel safe and comfortable and free to express themselves without harassment. So I think things could always be better, but I think that's down to the human approach, you know? Like, I find that if we have the basics covered, and everything in place that we would like to have in place for a show if we were on tour or whatever. All the rest is down to human beings, and you can't legislate for that. So if we can keep our end of the deal and keep our shit together, yeah, the rest generally, I find anyway, follows with it.
So that's going to be 10 years next year, like you say. Has label been, I guess, successful, in your opinion?
It's been going
a while, so...
It has been. The fact that we're... It even exists as a thing, blows my mind almost every day. You know, if I still get excited and a buzz whenever I get an email pings through that we've sold a record. You know, like, I enjoy the ritualistic aspect of putting the record sleeve together, cutting up your download codes, packaging, a little bit of care and attention. And when we're mailing out records, for example, I try to write like a personal note in with every order, and I'll chuck in free ship for people just because, like, I love buying records and getting records in the mail, and I know how stoked I am if there's like I don't know, like a free sampler or CD thrown in there or something, or a badge or whatever, because I'm a fan of the music and the process of it. So I like to think that if I can pass on some of that enthusiasm or that excitement, it can maybe be contagious and infectious, and other people will be stoked. So if I can make one person as stoked as I get through music, then I consider that a job done. And to answer the question, I would say it has been a success, because we didn't have a plan to begin with. The first plan was like, okay, we'll make these CDs and we'll play some shows, and that went pretty well. And then we did a couple more, then started doing Joey Terrifying, and Joey Terrifying did pretty well. And that was when we did quite a lot of touring and got the name around, kind of like the label. And then, and we broke up 5 years ago. And then with Uniforms, I did a lot more touring than we did in Joey Terrifying, and we put out our own shit, and we always stuck to that. And then for the first time, we had other labels who were wanting to put out our stuff and work with us. And with all the touring and grafting that we did, I think that kind of fed into the label as well. And that's how we met lots of our friends from America and around Europe. So as far as being a success goes, I would say we had no plan, and something now exists. So there's been a creation there. So yeah, I think that makes for success in itself. I mean... would obviously, it would be tremendous to be making thousands of pounds and not need to work and have a day job and do all that. But at the end of the day, and it's very Genesis, it was a vehicle for putting out our own CDs. So, yeah, I would say it's a success, and everything else that's happened has been just a series of fortunate circumstances and surprises, and continues to be a challenge. But I really wouldn't have it any other way. And I like the fact that we've really not compromised on any of our principles. And I'm proud of all the bands that we've worked with and the music that we've put out. And if I've been able to help some of my friends or our friends' bands put out music that might not previously have been out there, then I consider that a success. So yeah, I'm happy with how things have developed. Things could always be a little better, but we learn with every release, with every show, with every new enterprise. So hopefully we can continue along that learning curve, and we'll see what the future brings.
You mentioned that they're still sometimes challenging. What are some of the biggest challenges you've faced over the past 10 years?
Venues in Dundee has been a problem. That's kind of reared its head from time to time. We were kind of a little spoiled when Kenny, who's part of our collective, he ran Cage. So we had a home base for essentially 5 years, which was great because we had the run of the place. But it was also really quite hard work because it was a club, and it's a great club, but it wasn't a venue. Like, we had to bring in PA and all the gear every single time that we did a show, which was a challenge, but one that we enjoyed. And after a few years and a lot of shows, we kind of knew what we were doing, and we kind of built it from the ground up. Started really, really basic. And then as we gained more experience and knew what we were doing a bit more and knew how to interact with people, like, because we were learning as we were going along as well. Like, we knew the logistics. You need a backline, you need a PA, blah, blah, blah. You know all that stuff, the principle of it. But it's another thing entirely when you're doing it on a regular basis and you're needing to build these PAs and set up a stage. It's almost like creating a venue out of nothing, just from the space. So that was a challenge to begin with. And then Kenny sold up his interest in the club because he was working full-time as well as running the club, and he did this for 8 years. So finding a home base in Dundee has been a little difficult, but we've started with a place called Room at the Top, which is in the same, it's actually the same building as Cage. It's just the venue above it. And we've been doing shows in Buskers, which is a cool space, but it's a rock venue. It's part of the machinery of the Scottish and wider music industry. It's not principled on DIY punk rock or how we would do things. It's a business, and I understand that. And obviously these places have their place, and it's, but I feel we exist outside of that machinery. And it's not to denigrate the place at all. It's, as I say, it's a great mid-sized rock venue. It sounds really good. Like, Dougie the Booker's a cool guy, Russell the sound man's a good friend of mine, and everybody loves the big shows, you know, like when you've got like Andrew Jackson Jihad or Dead to Me or Big American Band. Everybody loves the shows where there's like 150-200 people there, and for a place like Buskers, that's tremendous, you know. But when it comes to the lifeblood of the DIY punk scene, which is like, say, your Tuesday night obscure German punk rock band who are maybe going to bring 20-30 people out in a space like Buskers, A, it's expensive. B, if you've got 30 people in there, it's going to seem cavernous and empty, whereas if you have a basement or a floor show and there's 30 people there, you know that those 30 people there are there because they want to come and support the music. Whereas in commercial venues, if you're just putting on a show, it's like sometimes it can be like you're interrupting people's beer, people that are out for a quiet pint, and that doesn't make for a comfortable environment for anybody, and doesn't make economic sense for us as a collective to be spending a lot of money on venues. Say, for example, you've got this DIY tour coming in, you've said you're going to pay 150 quid for the band, you're going to put them up, you're going to feed them, usual standard deal. Well, when you need to pay for venues, a 150-pound show becomes a £250 show, which means you might be able to cover the band, but you're going to lose your money on your venue. And that's okay, but it's unsustainable. And you can't keep doing that. I mean, I know a lot of promoters... Well, not a lot, but I know promoters who have lost money hand over fist and continue to do so and don't seem to see that there's a problem or where the disconnect comes in. And I have no issue whatsoever, like, at all, with if we're down on money, paying out of our own pocket to pay a band. You know, I've been in touring bands, I know the drill. That money can be important. It's your lifeblood of getting from A to B, you know. So no qualms whatsoever paying bands. But when it comes to venues that would otherwise be empty and you've had 30-40 people in drinking all night and you're getting charged venue hire, it just makes it unsustainable. And especially if you're losing out on money that could have gone to a band or could have gone towards our next show or next release or whatever, that's unsustainable. And that's something that we faced in Dundee this year for the first time. So that's been a fresh challenge. But as I say, that's something that's continually developing. And you asked about the long game and the plan. We do have a long game, kind of long-term plan. The ideal is to have our own space. That takes time and money, capital, which I'm sure we could find if we needed to. But it's just a matter of finding the right space. Dundee, as I say, is developing at the moment. You know, there's a lot of investment and money going around there. Not that we're seeing any of it, but there are opportunities available. I think it's just, for us, it's a matter of timing and finding the right space. So that's something that we're working towards. And we're continually developing that idea. There's nothing set in stone, but we will let everybody know as soon as there is some news on that front. And beyond that, challenges, most of it's been a pleasure. You know, there's been most of the challenges, I think, have been learning how to deal with people, people's expectations. One of the beauties of the DIY punk scene and punk rock in general is people don't tend to have unrealistic expectations. There's not a lot of diva behaviour. There's only a couple of times there's been issues as regards money. Certain bands have been like, oh, well, you agreed this. And we've always paid. We've never knowingly or deliberately underpaid a band. But there have been occasions where bands have been like, well, we need more money than we agreed. Not going to name any names, obviously, but what you learn from that is you just don't have these people back. And the punk rock community, word gets around, you know. Like, you don't want it to sound like a boys' club or a hush-hush secret network or anything, but you got to treat people like you'd like to be treated yourself, you know. Like, I'm a great believer in kind of what goes around comes around, man, you know. And we've learned that. And you just have to do the best that you can with what you have. And just from the years, it's not been a challenge as such, just a continual learning curve. There's challenges that come with touring and being in a band and being away from home and speaking and sounding like I do and trying to communicate with people in foreign countries and stuff. But that's a completely, like, that's a joy. That's a good challenge, you know. And I think we've been doing it long enough that there's not really, we're not too worried. You know, we're not really a panicky kind of crew. We like to plan our shit out, and we've got a resourceful crew, you know. So I would say it's been a learning, a developmental experience rather than a challenging one, I think. I need you like a hole in the head. A hole in the head. A hole in the head. I need you like. We'll be right back.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Do you often find, or have you often found, not just with the label, but generally in your sort of musical creative life, I guess, that do you often find yourself rubbed up against that kind of commercial interest, like in the way that you have done for getting venues in Dundee, for example?
Well, there's been a couple of instances where we've had advertisers and like people want to get on board. There is a company, a brewery, who I won't name, but at one point, we messaged them and we're like, would you be interested in getting involved in doing this? We could be doing a little bit of help, blah, blah, blah. Pitched them a couple of ideas and they weren't interested at all. Like, didn't even receive a response. And then a couple of years later, once things had started to get a little, kind of the wheels had began to turn a little more and we had Leatherface up to play and Dead to Me and stuff. For the next Bucharin Fest, we had an email from this brewery saying, oh, we'd maybe be interested in getting involved. And it's like, well, we don't need your help anymore. When we needed your help, you weren't interested, and now we don't need your help, you're kind of bandwagoning or something. So we turned that down. And I think that's the only kind of commercial proposition we've ever really had. I mean, the way that bars and businesses and live music works and everything, you know, like, most people are worried about getting money over the bar, how much money are they going to make on the bar, money, and I understand that money is important. It is, because it fucking fuels everything, you know. But it's never been a central focus of ours, and it's never driven what we do. Me personally, I almost deliberately try and kind of go against that. I think the more quote unquote successful we've become, the deeper my interest in grindcore, hardcore, crust, and anarcho punk has become. I've kind of, my own personal taste maybe moved away a little bit from a kind of melodic punk rock that pervades, you know, kind of bro punk or whatever. I've never really been a massive, like, pop punk person. Certainly not in the new school of kind of pop punk. So there's almost like this divide in the punk scene as well. You've got your overtly commercial pop punk. I couldn't even give you a name of a band, but like, you'll see like loads of kids going out to see, I don't know, A Day to Remember or something like that. But you'll never see these similar bands out at like a DIY punk show. So I think there's a disconnect in the punk scene there as well. I think there's like the commercial kind of punk scene, the bands that will maybe play the Garage and play for some other big promoters, come and play the Classic Grand or whatever, which is completely valid, you know. But it's just not the game that I play. It's not where my interest lies. So commercialism has never really been something that's we've had to wrestle with. I mean, with Uniforms, there was a couple of labels interested in doing stuff with us, and There was talks at various points of, oh, could this happen, could that happen? But ultimately, we didn't think there was any point. It's like, we can do this all ourselves. We can remain in control. And if it goes well, then great. If it fucks up, then it's our fuck up. So that's why we've always kind of stuck with doing things our own way. I mean, it's great to have help. You know, I'm not relentlessly beating a DIY drum. I'm not, I certainly try not to be overtly holier than thou about it. Like, we would have never got our US tour booked if it wasn't for having a booker over there and having friends over there, you know. But commercialism as a concept, the biggest issue that we've had running the label is we don't have enough Caddish records. Like, they sold out straight away, pretty much. And because we're just a small label, we are way down the line when it comes to getting into pressing plants. That's my latest bugbear, you know, like, major labels can afford to go slap bang, there's a $1 million exclusivity contract, you just press our records now. Here's the fourth repress of the digitally remastered Led Zeppelin 2 record from 71 that they're selling to people for the third or fourth time, you know, but which is, again, their license to print money. And they don't care about the hardcore man from Dundee who need a repress of their LP. So that angle of it is kind of frustrating. And you're always fighting against the big boys, you know. Like, they're always going to, whether it's shows, promoters, labels, pressing plants or whatever, you're always going to be getting squeezed when you're doing it, trying to do it independently, trying to do it your own way, trying to do it with without commercial goals in mind. But that's the biggest thing. Mostly, I guess, we just operate out with the sphere of commercialism, so it's not really something that I put a lot of creed into. If it pays for itself, tremendous. If we lose a shitload of money, well, touch wood, that's never actually happened. We have lost money on shows, you know. Everybody has. I don't think you could meet anybody that puts on shows that's never lost money. But we've never lost hundreds of pounds. I think there was one show, and it's when we were in America. And we tried to do a show, run a show back here as well, and it didn't quite work out, you know. But that was once, and that was anomalous. So as long as you do things smartly, you book things with a plan in mind rather than just going, yeah, we'll give you 600 quid on a Wednesday. You know, if you're smart about these things and you give it a little bit of thought, it's achievable. But it's also good to have a backup plan in mind as well. So if we ever make any money on shows, which is rare, it just goes straight back into the pot. And there's always something else needs paid for. There's always, we need to get sleeves for this record done, or we need to get another batch of t-shirts pressed up, or there's always something else. So all the money that comes in immediately goes straight back out into something else. So none of us are making money off it. We all work full-time jobs. Some of us work more than one job. So it's not a money-making enterprise, but if we can make it pay for itself, then I consider that a success.
The sense of community is obviously quite strong. You built it up over like 9 years. How do you feel when you reflect on that? How does that feel, like, that you've been part? I mean, from my point of view, Make That Take is quite an important part of the DIY punk scene in Scotland, and it's always been there. So is that something you ever consider? Like,
well, that's a lovely thing to hear. Kind of had a discussion about this sort of thing the other day, and it's not something that I consciously think about too much. Because, you know, you're always trying to, what's coming next? There's not an awful lot of time for reflection. But I would like to think that we've done our graft, you know. We've kind of done things on a grassroots level. I think our evolution has been gradual. And I think the label's grown as we've grown as people. And it's nice to feel part of something, I guess. It's not why we did it, but the community and the Scottish punk rock in general is just tremendous. I mean, today There's going to be, 150, 200 people knocking around later on. Bukharain Fest's always crazy busy. And I would like to think we've contributed positively to our community. And, I mean, it's lovely to hear people say things like, oh, it's you guys are an important part of the punk scene and stuff. Which, I mean, it's quite embarrassing almost. I kind of feel like quite shy and kind of blushing about it. It's quite silly, really, because it doesn't feel like it's been work to me, you know? I kind of feel like, or I like to think that I would still be doing this anyway, whether or not people were paying attention. And it's just like, made lifelong friends through the punk rock scene, you know? We're all looking for something. You don't get into DIY punk rock by listening to the charts or the radio or whatever. Even if you're into like commercial rock music, you might not know about, well, like if you look at it, like you'll get 2,000 people out to a Rancid show, but then like the rabble who are like from New Zealand who are just like Rancid sonically, you know, they might play to like 30 people, and it's like, where's that disconnect? Marketing, commercialism, major labels, awareness, like, you know, money is maybe that difference, but you don't stumble into DIY punk by accident, I guess. You kind of seek it out, and everybody I know in the punk scene is kind of a bit of a nerd, a bit of a misfit, a bit of a weirdo, but they know that, and it seems to be a commonality, you know, like people connect on a very personable and human level, that's bound together by something stronger than just the music, like, you know, the ethic, the way that you treat people, the way that you talk about people, the way that you express yourself. I think the punk scene, I mean, it's microcosmic of wider society, but as a generalized point, I think people plugged in and part of the DIY punk community are acutely aware of the expectations and the responsibility that they carry for themselves and for the punk scene, if you know what I mean. So it's almost like people know what's expected of them and what's not expected of them, and how to behave towards others. So if we've played any sort of role in bringing that together and bringing one person into that community or giving a positive experience or positive release to one person, then I think that's important, because people are important. There's 6 billion, 7 billion of us, but, you know, it's important to have that human connection. And I think that's ultimately, once you unpack all the other shit, is what's really important about DIY punk. It's the connection and the release and the giving people a space to do that, I guess. And to feel part of that, it's tremendously gratifying. And if someone takes something positive from it, if someone can take 1% of the positivity from punk rock that I've taken from it, then I'm happy.
That sense of community obviously powers everything you just said is basically powered by that sense of community. Do you ever reflect on that of like when it started for you, like when you sort of started to get that feeling of doing it all yourself? Like, what was the I know you talked about when it started, but like, what was the moment that you realised, hang on, I need to do this?
I don't really know if there was any one particular moment, but I remember on my 16th birthday, my band Humus Kaif were playing with a Dundee band called Mercury Tilt Switch and a band called Tennessee Kate, who were from Perth. And they were the kind of older boys that I knew. Like, I've got an older sister, and they were her pals who were slightly older. And we went and played this show with them at the Old Westport in Dundee. And it was then, I think, where it was just like, we can do this. Like, just like, they're doing it. They're awesome. Like, their bands were amazing to me. It was like, wow. And I remember seeing Tennessee Kate earlier on that year playing in Blairgowrie. And they're playing Ramones covers and playing like punk rock in the middle of Blair Gowrie's Well Meadow in the town centre, and jumping around and going nuts. And that was the first time I was like exposed to like live music that was anything other than classical or church music or anything like that, or like kind of cover bands or anything like that. So I think that was then, like, seeing them play, it was like, oh, I can do that. And that's when I really started to play guitar for the first time, because it was always Michael that played guitar. I always wanted to be like the lead singer and center of attention and jumping around. But seeing them play, it kind of set a light bulb in my head. It was like, I can do that. And it just went from there. And never really thought about it. Just kind of kept on keeping on doing what it is we try to do.
But there must have, surely there was a moment when you kind of went from liking the commercialist stuff to the stuff that you like.
Always used to get tapes, steal tapes from my sister and her pals, and she had this one pal that lived down the road who was a wee bit older, and he was a skateboarder, so I thought he was like the coolest guy, and he always used to give me tapes. So he always used to give me like Nirvana, Rage Against the Machine, and I remember getting a copy of The Offspring's Smash and reading through the liner notes. And I happened across Dead Kennedys, just the name, they were thanked in the thanks list, and I instantly loved that band. And I was just like, they're called Dead Kennedys, that's the greatest name I've ever heard. So I had a paper job at the time, and I saved up all my money, and I went through to Gold Rush Records in Perth and found this Dead Kennedys CD, and it was £15, and I was like, oh, that's expensive, you know, that's a month's saving. And I bought it, and the guy in the shop was like, oh, well, do you know about this? And he like showed me all like the Fat Wreck stuff, and I knew about Green Day, and I knew about The Offspring, and I'd heard people talk about like NoFX and stuff, but I didn't know anything about it. And then that just opened up this entire world for me. I guess this was probably about 95. I was aware of like Nirvana and stuff in like 91 through my sister and that, but I didn't really have like an active interest in it until I started like stealing the tapes and giving it a bit more listen. I guess it was Green Day and The Offspring that kickstarted my like active interest. And then once I found Dead Kennedys and went to Gold Rush Records and they were like, check out all this shit, that was when it opened up. There was never really one particular moment that blew my mind, just like a series of kind of mind-altering moments, perspective-altering moments, maybe it would be, like seeing Tennessee Kate, definitely, going to Gold Rush and buying that Dead Kennedys album, seeing Green Day in 98, it just kind of blew it all open. And by the time, like, I finished high school or whatever, it was like DIY punk, it was like, I was like, me and my buddies were like the only punks in school, you know. We went to Blair Gowrie High School. There was like 1,000 kids and 3 of us with like blue hair and garage worker shirts and wallet chains and shit like that. And then like the whole new metal thing kind of came out. And I was kind of into that, I'm not going to lie, you know. I wasn't too cool to listen to Limp Bizkit or Korn or whatever. But
was that a certain age, I think?
Totally. But also while it was happening, I was aware that it was kind of commercial rock bullshit at the same time, and we used to go to like Leeds and Leeds Festival, and we'd always like camp out in the lock-up stage and stuff rather than like being at the main stage. So I guess there was kind of an anti mainstream music thing going from when we were quite young, and like when we were young punks, we were interested in pissing people off and being offensive and gobby, and our bands were terrible. It took a long time of being really, really terrible until we stumbled upon being in any decent bands. But like when we were young and initially, like that was the thrill was in the doing of it. Whereas like now, the satisfaction comes in a different way, maybe, because you progress as a person and musically, and your abilities grow and whatever. But when we started making music, I didn't care about any of that. It was like, right, okay, cool, we've got a band. Okay, we suck, we can't play. We don't have a name. We don't have any songs, but we've got a band. And it was like kind of our little gang. And in a way, I guess, like, that's how people create their identities, you know, like, bouncing off your friends and you take on all these experiences and all these parts from other people and other places. And I guess by the time I kind of hit uni and started doing those shows in the garage and stuff like that, it was kind of, our map was kind of set, you know, like, we would see, like, the indie bands and stuff, like, doing their big shows, and they never seemed to, like, have fun. They never seemed to enjoy themselves, and people were always falling out with each other, and it's like, oh, well, we want to play last, or can we play, blah, 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 and it was like, I never understood why, like, people were meant to be enjoying themselves, and were just, it seemed to be such a hassle just to get up there and pout, and we were like, why don't you guys just, it was like, we'll go on first, we don't care, like, set up, go, play, be shit, play for 15 minutes, entertain yourself, like, if you can't entertain yourself, no one else is going to be entertained. You know, and that's all we ever really did to begin with. And sometimes we were deliberately obnoxious. And then we kind of started to figure out what we were doing. And then we're like, okay, well, actually, we're maybe not... There's maybe something of some value here. There's maybe something of some worth. So we continued to develop it, you know. And I think it's the same spirit of that exists till today, I think.
That's the same spirit that Make That a Take has, yeah.
Yeah, it's not even like DIY. It's almost like, right, if we don't put on the good punk shows in Dundee, there's not going to be any good punk shows in Dundee. It's not to say that there aren't, like, good punk bands that play in Dundee and people that make an effort and stuff, but it's like, we want to see the bands that we want to see, we're going to have to book them. And if we're going to book them, we might as well make it a fucking good job. Like, there's no point in half-assing anything. There's nothing worse than rocking up to play somewhere when it's clear that no effort's gone in and no one cares that you're coming or going. You know, there's nothing more disheartening, like, being in a band, rocking up to a place like that. And it's like, you know, nothing's ever going to be handed to you, so you need to create it for yourself. And it's almost kind of going back to that brewery thing, you know. Like, we could have been doing with a hand at, like, various points in time, and for me, it's like, it's good, it's nice to have the option, I guess, but it's also quite satisfying. I try not to dwell, and I don't really believe in pride and being like, oh, check us out, look what we've done all of this, our testicles are massive, look how much we've done. I'm not really about that. You don't want to come across as, like, up your cell. I think it's important. That's one of the lessons that I've learned. It's the importance of staying humble and being thankful and being appreciative for the people that make it happen. Because we could put on all the shows we want. We could do anything, really, we want. But it's not going to mean anything unless the people that come to the shows engage with it, you know? If it was a vanity project, it would have wrapped up a long time ago, because people would have been like, this is ridiculous, I'm losing so much money, blah, blah, blah. And thankfully, people have connected with it in a really kind of primal way. And I would like to think, anyway, that that's born out of the sincerity and the drive and the passion that we have for it. And hopefully that translates. And it's almost like, you can't expect anybody to be stoked on something if you're not stoked on it yourself. Like, why would you want to be like, oh yeah, here's our new record, it's okay. It's like, I don't want a record that's okay. I want a band to, like, make a record that's, like, the blood spilt on the record and you can hear. It's almost a part of quoting Billy Lyre there. He's, like, one of his songs. I want to see your blood spilled on the stage. I want to hear your heartbeat through the PA. That's exactly what you want. Like, you know, you get out what you put in, and that to me, that's the bottom line. You get out what you put in, and your punk scene will support you if you support your punk scene. And if you don't put anything in, you're never going to get anything out. And you've got to be willing to put yourself out there and fail. You know, you've got to be willing to fail and try and learn from those failures, rather than just being like, okay, that's shit. That didn't work out that one time. That shit, I'm never doing it again. Because if we had done that, we would have never done anything, we wouldn't be having this conversation just now. I would have never met people I've got, I call lifelong friends. I would never have got to play in some of the incredible places that I've had the privilege of playing music. And I owe so much of myself to it, that if, as I said before, if one person gets a fraction of what I've got from punk rock, then I would consider that a blessing.
I think that's a good note to end on, man. It's quite positive. Anything else you want to say?
Well, thanks very much for your time. Thanks for asking me to flap my gums. I'm no bad at that. Hopefully people will check out Make That A Take Records. We've got a new website for the first time in 10 years or so. It was Craig from Get It Together that did the website for us. That's another thing about the punk rock community. Like, we put out the Get It Together 7-inch. Craig did our website, and I went on tour with them all this year. And Craig was in my band 13 Broken Fingers when we were doing these gigs at Stirling Uni, like 12 years ago and stuff like that. So it is a family, it is a community, you know. And I would encourage everybody to seek out your local punk scene and get involved. Go to a show, start a zine, start a podcast, start a band, get involved, and just speak to somebody. You might find a pal. And if you don't get on with one person, then you might get on with the person standing next to you. Pick up a 7-inch, like Kimberly Steaks, for example. You might find your new favourite band. If you're not into them, you might like the Murder Burgers, you know. Like, it's all linked. So thanks to everybody that continues to support what we do. Thank you to you yourself for having me. It's been a pleasure. And keep up the good work.
Cheers, man. Thank you.
You know, I've interviewed a lot of people by this point. Some of them were great, like that one, and some of them were alright. I never ever tired of hearing someone talk at length about the things that they love. To see the fire in their eyes, the look in their face as they talk about something that's important to them. And that's a feeling, that's something that I'll never ever tire of seeing. My favourite thing about podcasting is that it's just you, the guest, and me. You're listening in on a conversation that I've recorded just for you. Conversations that I think are worth something, that are of real value, and that hopefully give you something inspiring or powerful or illuminating to take away. I think that one was no exception. Thanks for listening. Please take some time to check out the website. That's thecuratorpodcast.com for more information and to subscribe to the newsletter. I'm still doing okay in iTunes, new and noteworthy, and that's all because of you. So once again, and I'll never stop saying this, I'll never stop thinking this, thank you. I'm going to play you out now with a track from one of the very first ever Make That A Take releases. It's called You're Still All That Matters To Me by 15 Minutes. This is what Deeker had to say about this one. This album was one of the first two Make That A Take releases and features Michael, Gain, Lindsay and Barry Kidd, two founder members of Make That A Take. Gainy and I started our first band together in the mid-90s, and it was us who played that first show way back when in the Girl Guide Hut. This song was written in memory to our good friend Graham Motion of the band Allegro, and a whole crew of us are involved in the gang vocals. I think this song and sound encapsulates the purity of our intent and the sincerity of our delivery. Everything we've done since then has been built on these principles. Thanks for listening. Until next time.
It's a hard life when you look at what we've done. It's a long road. Look how far we've come. And nobody said this was gonna be easy. All they said was we'll be. And we'll pick you up and we'll dust you off and we'll wipe away your tears. And some of us never made it. Some of us never stood a chance. Some of us just live for the nights where we can sing, get drunk and dance. And shadows of our past wander every street in this town. I felt sick in my stomach the day I walked past and they pulled the old Westie down. And it's times like this when you realize that everything is through.
buildings missing along the streets, and the old friends who have gone. There will always be time to reminisce about places, faces that we all miss. Keep the memories alive in story and song, and invite new friends in to sing along. Look out for each other, cause you're all we've got. We won't be told, sold, rented or bought. You've earned your place in my heart where you will always be. When we are together, hope you can see. So come on and sing with me.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.